Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com. This is Floss Weekly with Chris DeBona, Episode 9 for July 14th, 2006. Randall Schwartz. Episode of Floss Weekly. We took a couple of weeks off while I scanned my hard drive for missing interviews. We'll find them. We will. I can't lose another
one. Jeremy's going to kill me if you lose another one.
Oh, if I can't find it, steak dinner for all. Every 50,000 people who are listening to this show. But we do have a great guest today. Do you want to kind of describe Randall Schwartz for us?
It's hard to describe Randall. He's a remarkable developer. First and foremost, I know him as a brilliant Perl developer, and he has been for a decade plus. You know, I first met him because of the open source conventions, which were the Perl conferences, which a lot of people don't know. And he has been a fixture in Perl for longer than most people have ever been programming it, just shy of Larry Wall himself.
And he's quite
a personality.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in fact, without further ado, let's say hello to Randall Schwartz.
Randall and I met each other a couple times at Perl conferences, and we've bought each other drinks and stuff at bars.
Yes.
And talked about things, especially during his what we like to call his interesting period.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting period, yes, right.
Which we'll probably touch on.
That's fine. Don't make the whole show about that, though.
No, we won't.
Please. I
mean, well, now that you've brought it up, I think we're going to have to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how I met Randall. I didn't know who Randall was when I first met him because it was on a geek cruise, and I thought he was Captain Neil's assistant. I didn't really know who he was. And then
Captain Neil?
Yeah, he's the guy who runs the geek cruises. We got to get you on one of these. But the name Randall Schwartz, I thought, Randall Schwartz. And then it suddenly, I think I was in my cabin, and a light bulb went on. I went, Learning Perl. Oh, my God. So I actually have Randall's book, Learning Perl. I don't know if I have all your books. What are some of the other books you've written?
I also have the sequel to Learning Perl, which is now called Intermediate Perl. Originally, it was titled The Mouthful of Learning Perl Objects, References, and Modules, which was just impossible to say.
I didn't buy that one. I was scared. Yeah. I was scared off by that.
The title is so long that most people can't even say it when they go to the store. So we retitled that. We optimized it to Intermediate Perl.
Also an O'Reilly book.
Also an O'Reilly book. In fact, that has the alpaca for its release party. We actually brought in a live alpaca at OSCON. It was really fun.
I've never gotten an animal. Both of mine were compilations, and so I didn't warrant the animal.
I love those
animals. No animals. Oh.
I know. I'm gonna have to write a book.
I love
a real one. You know.
I love those animals. So, how long have you been a Perl master?
Master, I'm still almost there. But in terms of working with Perl, I have been working with Perl. I actually downloaded Perl version 1, which at this point would be 1980, I believe, is the year that came out. And I downloaded that, and I played with it a little bit, and I was kind of a big SID. And then I'd also been using RN quite heavily, which was Larry Wall's previous claim to fame. And I thought, well, this Perl thing might work out pretty well. And so I played with it a little bit, and it just didn't have quite what I needed. So I downloaded Perl 2 the next year and started playing with that. Now, by download, I mean it comes in a 45-part Usenet posting that you had to assemble just right and had to get all the parts without any pieces missing. I'm sure you all, for the people that just haven't done anything but the old days, this is the way we used to have to do this. And it was transmitted on modems that went as fast as 1200 baud. A 1200 baud.
Did you have a Perl program to put Perl together?
No, actually, it was a shell script. There was a Perl program that would actually split a file into multiple parts so they could be reassembled. I believe Larry had a little bit to do with that as well. But anyway, so Perl 3 is actually where it took off for me. And I believe that was 1989, somewhere right in there. Downloaded that, and I went, oh, my gosh, this is really kind of cool. I think there's a lot of things here that I can actually use. In fact, I was actually involved with Perl 3 from the time it was released as sort of an alpha release. release. I got involved on the Perl 3 development team to kind of help Larry test it on different platforms. I didn't know Larry other than him being a name on the net, but he had posted a little message saying, if anybody wants to help me develop Perl 3, I'm interested to it. Mostly what I did is I compiled it on the machines I had access to, and I learned a lot about it, and I gave him feedback about various features that I think might be missing. For example, the underscore file handle is mine, as well as the literal slice where you can put parens around a list and put square brackets after.
I just like that to say the underscore file handle. That's mine. I did that.
Yeah, that's mine. I invented that. I only have four features that I contributed to the language, so I have to like make claim when I can.
And then you had the slice. What part of the slice?
The literal slice. When you could take an arbitrary list expression, put parens around it, and put square brackets after. That was my invention. Because prior to that, you had to send it into an array and then do an array slice and bring them back out. And I thought that was a waste of time and space. So
how do you get things like that approved? Do you go to Larry and say, Larry, we need this?
No, it's actually pretty simple. Well, yeah, I mean, at that point, I was one of the inner circle at that point because I was just, you know, I was on the Larry's mailing list. And I said, Larry, you know, I kind of would like this feature. And he said, yeah, I can see a use for that. And so he put it in. It's still sort of that way today, even with the Perl 6 development effort, that people are still sort of suggesting things. And Larry sorts through the language design issues to bring that online. But no, back then, it was a much smaller circle. So
and
I
there
was
are those
able to contribute.
Critics who would say that that might be what's wrong with Perl is that there are, as Larry says, there's more than one way to do everything.
Well, I think, though, if you watched Larry's design process on this, I think probably you'd disagree a bit. I've had the opportunity to watch it up close. Larry doesn't just add a feature because it's a new feature. Larry looks at each feature carefully and decides, you know, A, is there already a way to do exactly the same thing? If there is, no, we're not going to just add a different way to write exactly the same thing. I mean, even take the comma versus fat arrow, the equal greater than. At first glance, they look like they're exactly the same thing. You could use either one where you could use the other. But the fat arrow has the extra thing that it also quotes the left-hand side as a bare word. So it's not quite the same, and so that's the reason they both exist. They exist for syntactic differences so you can see the difference, but also because there's a slight, you know, functional difference between the two of them. And so when Larry's looking at a new feature, he says, does it open up a new problem space? Can we solve more problems with it? And is it not exactly the same as something we already have? So while there is more than one way to do most things, it's because you have overlapping solutions that are optimized for particular problem spaces.
But I would say that you just kind of underscored a philosophical kind of difference in that language, which is eliminate as much typing as possible. You know, things like the fat equals, because then you don't have to do quoted bare words. The fat arrow.
I don't know that it's so much eliminating typing as for the same reason that we say can't instead of cannot. If it's a very common thing to use, we find ways to shorten those down. And that's the optimizations that are made in Perl. It's not because we're trying to eliminate keystroke after keystroke. It's
or
because
confuse
we're
the
saying,
heck out of new users.
Or confuse the heck out of new users. It's because, you know, you would not fault an English speaker for saying cannot. But if he keeps saying over and over again cannot, you go, dude, it's can't. You know, and that's the same attitude that we take towards Perl shortcuts, is that for fluent speakers, not that I'm an English speaker apparently right now, but for fluent speakers, it's easier to use the contractions, the mm-hmm. concatenations, the shortened cuts, and it's not to be cryptic, it's not to save keystrokes, it's just that, you know, we get tired of saying cannot over and over again, let's use can't, and that's the same thing that happens in Perl.
So here's the thing. So I started using Perl, so I went basically, you know, learning BASIC, then C, and I loved C, but I wanted something that worked faster, so I used Perl. And I liked it a lot. However, sometimes those conventions drove me up the wall, because it's like, okay, well, wait, what's actually happening in the program? Like when you're doing loops across files, and you just do the print inside the loop, you know, that kind of thing, and then it just sort of works. And it took me a good amount of time before I was sort of confident that I sort of knew how Larry was thinking. But once you get to that point, see, that's like the magic point for Perl for me, is when you get to that point. But leading up to
Well, I can recommend
painful.
A couple of good books for that, so.
Oh, can you? Really?
Yes,
what's
really.
On the cover?
I would say a llama and an alpaca. But you're right. That is a definite point. It is that Perl is not designed for someone who's only going to be programming Perl an hour a week or an hour a month. Unless you're programming Perl 2 to 3 hours a week or more. That's kind of my threshold, I think. It wouldn't make any sense to do any less than that. And and Larry's thought again on that, I don't want to be quoting Larry the entire day, but Larry's thought on that is that you learn a language once and you use it many times. So unless you get that economy of scale where you actually have learned something complex once and get to use it many times, Perl does have a beginning mode where you can sort of use it as a beginner, but really the most powerful Perl programmers are people that are using it at least 2 or 3 hours a week, and maybe even more. Full-time Perl programmers can have, I would say, as much as, to be conservative, even one order of magnitude better production with Perl than the beginners will. And the real experts, of which there are probably a good few handfuls on the planet, are probably even closer to 2 orders of magnitude. There's just, it's an amazing ratio of ability to do skills with Perl. And there's not a lot of other languages that are out there like that.
Yeah, in fact, I'd actually be willing to say it even goes more than that, more than 2 orders. Because if you look at, like, how, say, a Brad Fitzpatrick codes Perl,
yes,
or how, say, Brian Aker would code Perl, or yourself, and I don't know if you actually like those people or not, but I do. And it's, like, it's pretty remarkable how they can both use things like CPAN and Perl and bring it all together really fast and really effectively, and the code works really well, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things I have to keep doing to keep up with my skills so that I'm useful to my clients is that I'm watching the 30 to 40 new uploads per day to the CPAN, 30 or 40 new module updates per day. In fact, that's more updates than we had in the dot-com boom of 1999.
Wow. Really?
Perl is being used for more advanced applications today than ever. People that are saying Perl's dead really just aren't paying attention to the CPAN uploads, the kind of projects that are being rolled out, the high-level frameworks that are being rolled out. Some really incredible stuff is being done. Some real large .com clients are using it in very big ways still, and basically the internet still travels on the backbone of Perl at some point.
Let's talk a little bit about CPAN, and then I want to talk about frameworks.
Yeah, what is it for the people who don't know what it is?
What is
the CPAN stands for the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network. About 10 years ago, I think it's almost exactly 10 years ago, in fact, we noticed that there were probably like an archive over here and an archive over there and an archive over there of interesting Perl gadgets, but they weren't unified, and you had to learn that this one had scripts and that one had these kinds of modules and this one had a different kind of module and stuff. So what they did is they got together and they said, you know, we ought to just all mirror the same stuff. And what that's evolved to skip forward 10 years is there's about 300 machines around the world that have announced themselves publicly as containing the entire, I think it's about 3 gigabytes of information now, and they're mirrored usually hourly, but sometimes daily, from the master machine in Finland. And any user can ask for what we call a pause ID that gives you essentially a short handle that gives you authorization to upload to the CPAN. So the barrier for entry is extremely low.
I didn't realize that. So is there nobody looking at what's going into CPAN?
Well, we all watch what comes out on it, but there's nobody gating it, and that low barrier to entry is what has allowed this kind of contribution to happen for absolutely, you know, no cost except my net connection to the PAWS upload machine. I can transmit a file, and within hours, it is mirrored on 200 systems around the world. And you'll see that in your CPAN shell as, oh, here's a new module that you might want to do, or it's an update to a module you had previously. It is a very low-cost system, low-cost meaning low energy by people to contribute. And I believe that's why there's, you know, 50,000 modules on the CPAN and 30 to 50 uploads a day, and that's why the other languages are jealous of the CPAN.
Oh, yeah.
The other open source projects are jealous because there is almost nothing that I can't first go to the CPAN and say, oh, there's something that does most of what I want.
Right,
I can use it as a building block and go forward.
I think the greatest strength of Perl is the CPAN archive.
Yeah, this was totally driven home for me when I was looking up for a Python Jabber module. And it's like some of the CPAN modules are just so much better, you know. It's like, oh.
It really pushes people, I think, to use Perl just because so much of what they want to do has already been written.
Yes, I mean,
it concerns me that I always assumed that stuff that's on CPAN was highly vetted. So that concerned me
a little
bit. Welcome
to the internet, Leo.
I just assumed that if a Perl module, if a library module is up there on CPAN, it does what it says it's going to do, pretty much bug free. That is not the case.
That is not the case. I can publish something that is very malicious, and within 24 hours, it will be on 200 machines around the world. Has that ever happened in the history of CPAN? No. Could it happen tomorrow? Yes. But we do have in place the archivist, the master archive guy, his backup people are all like online, you know, 24/7 somehow or another, so that if we do see something malicious, we can quickly get it off the archives again. And just in terms of quality, there are CPAN rating systems. If you go to search CPAN.org, you can go to a particular module page, and there's a place to submit ratings and look at other people's ratings about something. There's a place to even annotate the documentation so that the original author can actually update his docs based on your annotations of what you think the docs actually mean. There's also a full bug RT, which means that I can submit bugs, and they're recorded in a central place, and he immediately gets email that there's something wrong with his code and can be tracked using a formal bug tracking system. So there's a number of things that are in there to keep this at a high-quality level. In the history of the CPAN, there's only been one person who did something marginally malicious, and within 15 to 20 minutes of discovering of this, and about another 10 or 15 minutes of chatting about it on IRC and a couple of the mailing lists, he was blacklisted from the CPAN. All of his modules instantly disappeared around the world, and he had to explain why he was doing what he was doing. He was essentially phoning home in his Makefile PL, the thing that you use when you install it. He was phoning home and evaling random code that came off a URL. And that's not good.
That's scary.
It's extremely scary. Yeah. He was not doing it maliciously, though. He was doing it not understanding that if his machine ever became owned, that it would be malicious to everybody who installed it. And the versions he replaced it with are much more benign. They still phone home if you tell them it's okay, and they don't eval any code that's coming down the wire anymore.
I think a lot of people who use CPAN, though, stick with the big power modules like LWP.
Absolutely.
And they just do so much for you that it really adds immensely to the language.
And anything that's big like that is registered, which means that a particular developer is the only one that can upload stuff in that namespace. So you will never find anybody else that will just maliciously or can possibly maliciously update LWP user agent and replace it with their own. That is a restricted namespace, and you can apply for a restricted namespace and get it within about 2 weeks. But once that is vetted, then really, Gisela Oos, the guy that does LWP, is the only one that can put stuff in that namespace. So if I tell you, Leo, to go download, LWP user agent, I can be pretty well assured that that's definitely something that came from Gisela.
Yeah.
So one thing that we try to ask people who come on the show is how you yourself got into computing at all, Was it tubes? What was it?
He was a hacker.
Quite tubes. I was a hacker of a different kind, back when hacker meant a good thing. But anyway, how I got into computing, actually at a very early age, when I was, believe it or not, I think it was 6 or 7, I was playing with a little bit of early mathematics and things like that. And my dad and I would work together on electronics. We, electrical stuff, we subscribed to Pop Electronics. Now, I'm talking, this is 1969, 1968, somewhere right in there, just before small computers and stuff started showing up. But so we would work together. We would build these TTL circuits with discrete AND gate and OR gate and things like that. We'd plug these together, and it turned out my dad was a blue collar worker. He was self employed. He would do heating and air conditioning stuff, and he worked for this guy who was an electronics distributor. An electronics distributor had a stack of books that he sort of traded him as they got as a some sort of stuff from the marketing guys. And Dad brought these books home, and one of the first ones I was looking at was manuals on the PDP-8 system.
Oh, wow.
And I would go through, and I started looking at the instruction set, and I went, this is really cool. You can put instructions step by step in this core memory, actual core. And it was 4K was the entire size of the entire system. But they had this one other book that just attracted me like crazy. There was this language called Focal, F-O-C-A-L. And it was basically sort of looked like Fortran, but it was Dec's answer to that. And I wrote a couple of programs in Focal, and I took that to my dad and I said, Dad, this is what I want to do. I want to write instructions down and have the computer follow them. That real. And my dad was lucky. He talked to the administrator of the high school. And while I was just barely entering junior high, which was 2 years early because I didn't go to third or fourth grade, as I was just barely entering junior high, I was able to go to the high school on Saturday morning. So the high school was just a block from my house, so it made it pretty easy. And they had an ASR33 teletype attached via a 110 baud modem, uppercase only, attached to a computer system that was, a good, 20 miles away that the school systems had set up to do support. And I learned BASIC. The very first BASIC program that I ever wrote was 110 lines long, and it worked perfectly the first time.
Wow.
And
so you had a knack for this. I think you had a natural ability.
By the time I got into high school, I was using that very same terminal unit for an hour before school, during my entire lunch, and for 2 hours after school every day in this little closet of a room, this noise of entire time. So I have no hearing left at all. I'm doing everything by Braille here right now. So that's just a complete non sequitur now. But that's how I got started. And by the time I was in high school, I was teaching it to other people. But I was, as a junior and senior in high school, I was already contracting. In 1977, wow. I was contracting at $30 an hour writing basic programs. And I said, why go to school? So I went immediately from there to Tektronix for 5 years. They hired me. I was their youngest salaried employee and highest paid minor for a couple of years. So I got in when I was 16. I was a salaried employee at age 16, making $24,000 a year, I believe, at the
so
time.
Did you ever?
Not bad for 16.
Did
huh?
you?
No.
So, did you ever formally study computer science in any?
No, no. It's everything I do is self-taught. It's funny because I've never been to college, but I've taught as a graduate level professor at our local graduate school. So I've actually taught computer programming 500 level classes and they come up, they say Professor Schwartz, and I love
Professor
it because
Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, really. Dr. Schwartz. I know. It's like, it's just crazy. I don't, but I enjoy it. I live and breathe this stuff, and even much to my dismay about other things I might want to do. But it's natural to me. Like people before, I can't write a book on how to program because I never had a time in my life that I can recall now before I knew how to program.
Wow.
And in order to write a book about something, you got to do both the before and after. You got to see what the differences were. So when someone doesn't understand why a subroutine works or why a variable works, I can't quite remember why I already knew that.
It just makes sense to you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But you mentioned frameworks. Now, one of the reasons Ruby is getting so much attention right now is because, of course, Ruby on Rails.
Yes.
Are there similar frameworks for Perl?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the things we always like to joke
pails.
About. Perl on planks. Yes, Perl on planks. No, the problem is that there's already so many frameworks that are being used that there's not the one to catch people's attention.
Yeah, Rails has great marketing and great PR. And so, I mean, it's not necessarily the best thing in the world, but it's just got this great PR machine.
And part of the problem is that because Perl is still viewed by the blogosphere as being that old thing that your grandest, even though it's still being used heavily for probably most of the websites they visit.
As they use their LiveJournal that runs on Perl.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. They whine about Perl when they're typing on LiveJournal. That's really funny. I love that. But they...
some of your favorite frameworks now.
The ones that would be closest to Ruby on Rails would probably be the actively developed Catalyst framework, which is pretty close to what Ruby on Rails is. There's also Jifty, which is up and coming, which allows really nice continuations where you can actually program in your Perl subroutine like you just sort of magically call the user here and you come right back to where you left off. There's some really cool stuff going on in the Perl community regarding that. A lot of the stuff, unfortunately, is not so much sent into the CPAN because there's a lot of the large frameworks that we're using to build big websites like what Amazon does and a few other big locations, say Ticketmaster. Those are all Perl behind the scenes. What those things are starting to do is that they've got some really great frameworks, but of course they're all company proprietary, so we can't get at those.
Yeah, right.
But for a sort of a head-on closest comparison, I think Catalyst comes pretty close, and that is in very, very active development. Lots of things work exactly the same way. Don't repeat yourself. Automatic binding back to the insert, update, delete stuff. I forget what that's called. Darn it. But that sort of thing. That's all provided in there. And so we look at what Ruby's doing, and we're going, okay, well, great for opening up the namespace for us, making sure that people understand that late binding languages can be useful again. But we've been doing the same thing for 15 years before you came around. So here we are.
Yeah. What you've mentioned now, both you and Chris have mentioned some well-known Perl implementations. Give me a list of sites that are running Perl that people may not realize are running Perl.
Well, I think probably the one that most people recognize is Ticketmaster. I mean, it's just amazing that you're sitting here at Ticketmaster, CitySearch, and Match.com. It's all the same company, and all that's Perl behind the scenes. I could probably go get a list off the net, but there's like a huge number of people running Mod Perl. CBS Sportsline.com is all Perl.
Mod Perl is the Apache extension that makes Perl a very efficient CGI.
Right. Yeah. And when most people think Perl and why it's not good for the net, they think, oh, well, that's just because CGI is so old hat. But that's because we're not using CGI for all these big sites. I mean, Amazon.com is using Perl for most of the stuff in and out. Companies like Yahoo.com are using Perl for all of their internal APIs that actually make them money. So, you know, that's the important thing. It's being used for a lot of the sites.
Internet Movie Database, Live Journal,
yeah. Internet Movie Database is all Perl.
Google uses Perl on the inside in places, not as much as other people, but you know,
I think
it's pretty rare to find a site that doesn't have some Perl lying around.
It's lost some of the sex appeal. You know, it's losing out to languages like PHP and now Python and Ruby, I think.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, and I think it's just because there's not really anything to talk about it. There's nothing. I mean, Perl is a mature language. It has, you know, there's not much more space it needs to get into to be useful for people. So it's not like we're releasing, oh my God, we've now figured out how to do objects. No, we don't have to say that. We were doing that 10 years ago. The only big thing on the forefront is Perl 6, and that's dragging on a little bit. But when Perl 6 comes out, I think it will reabsorb the Ruby community and a few other sort of side communities, just because, you know, it has the things that makes Ruby sexy, like the every object can have instance methods and things, and individual instance methods and things like that, and a much lighter syntax, actually a much more organized syntax. So everybody that complains about @a and $a3 being in the same variable will really love Perl 6 because we fixed that. It's now it's @a and @a3 in Perl 6. So
is that your come on now more Ruby like?
It could be. I don't see any reason not to. I mean, I think.
It is one of the things I like about Ruby, though. I have to say, it seems a cleaner syntax. Object orientation is kind of it's a forethought, not an afterthought. Things. Like
and Perl 6 is that way too. Perl 6 will have formal object specification. No longer do you somehow like make up a little hash and say, bless this hash, and now all of a sudden it's magically an object.
Right.
Yeah, Perl 6 has a formal, you know, here are my attributes, here are the inherited classes, here are the roles that this thing brings in, essentially mix-ins, things like that. So it's got all of this sort of modern technology. Plus, it was built on Parrot, which is a virtual machine framework that Ruby can compile to, and Python can compile to, and even Java can compile to, and C-sharp can compile to. And what's great is when you mix all these things together, you can have a C-sharp subroutine calling Java, calling Perl, calling Ruby, calling Python, and no longer will you have to decide, well, I love Ruby, but I want to use the CPAN. You'll be able to say, I want to use Ruby with this CPAN module,
that's
and it all just plays together.
Is it
and
threaded?
Threaded support, everything's in there. Parrot is an amazing development. That's why it's taking so long. All the current modern technology is going into it. Also, we're actually working with the Mozilla folks to see if we can get it embedded in Mozilla, which would be really nice because then it will be like JavaScript and embedded Java was, it will be the bytecodes that you can send to run things in a controlled environment in your browser. You'll be able to script in any one of those languages I just mentioned because they will all interoperate, compile down to Parrot code, then you send a Parrot jar, essentially, or whatever they're going to be called, par maybe, back down to your browser, and you're done. Yeah.
I think it's already Python archive, though.
Oh, shoot.
There's also Perl archive, so yeah.
How's Mozilla responding to that? Because that sounds like a wonderful thing.
Mozilla's been going out to a lot of different languages to expand sort of the idea of not just JavaScript, but you know, Perl, Python, you name it. You know?
But Parrot would be a good choice because it's kind of an underlying virtual machine that can support them all.
And there's already a mod Parrot. It's a little bit experimental, but you can actually take the code that you can compile today in Perl 6 and compile it down to Parrot bytecodes and load that into mod Parrot and essentially a par archive, whatever they're calling that now. And what's great is that if you look at the Perl 6 archives, there's actually about 20 or 30 experimental languages, including things like Basic and Lisp and Fortran and COBOL and a few other Befunge that are essentially have compilers written that are already targeting Parrot. So you could actually write something in Befunge, compile it through this compiler, spits out in Parrot, run that in mod Parrot, and there you have it embedded in your web page today.
It must be fairly simple to write a Parrot compiler then.
Parrot is a really nice low-level language. There's actually a lot of code being written directly in Parrot.
It's a virtual machine, so is it almost like a machine language?
It's a little bit higher level. You could do things like say, this is an object coming in, call this method on this object. object, but it's done in a sort of assembly language syntax. There's actually a C-like syntax that you can also use that isn't the entire language exposed to you, but you can get pieces of it using a sort of a C-like syntax to it. But yeah, they're already in Parrot, from what I understand at the last week's conference, is that already in Parrot, you can there's a thing that does essentially grammars. You feed an entire grammar saying, you know, an expression is a term plus a term, and you feed that sort of thing down in through this compiler that's written in Parrot, and out comes Parrot bytecodes that will parse that kind of a language.
Sounds like Forth.
There's actually a Forth target for Parrot as well. Yes. Yes. If you go in there, there's something like I said, 25-30 languages that as proof of concept to make sure that Parrot had enough breadth to really cover the possible things you'd want to target for it. They've been making these little experimental, most of the language, not complete yet, but most of the language to make sure that they have the right constructs in there. And it's been really successful. And that's actually guided a lot of the design of Parrot is, can we do a lot more than Perl 6 with it? Can we actually be a nice, fast, free virtual machine that's licensed not under just the GPL, but licensed as Perl is, including under the artistic license. So you can take that and embed it in your commercial application, and we don't care. Just put Perl somewhere in the README, and that's all you need to do.
Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about the difference between the Perl artistic license and the GPL?
Well, sure. So,
I mean, I don't know if that's a rabbit hole or if
it's really it's not actually. So, actually, I think that Randall would probably have something to say about the GPL, looking at his last six suggested topics that he sent us.
I didn't get that list, so I'm going to have to let you.
I forwarded it to you.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
We can go through it real quick. Okay. It's real simple. Perl you can use in commercial programs without a lot of problems at all. It's very, very easy to do.
Whereas the GPL
the GPL will require you to share the code that you use with.
It has to be open source.
It's very simply.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, the artistic license is pretty close to the BSD license, which is basically says you just have to kind of attribute it somewhere. The nice thing is that
like in a README on a file on the disk, yeah. It's very, very simple.
If you
call them notice
Perl
licenses internally.
Yeah, if you release Perl, though, if you make a modification of Perl and start shipping it somewhere, you can't call that Perl. That's about the only restriction that's in the artistic license. And that's because we don't want marketplace confusion where there's like two different Perls both being downloaded from two different sites. So that's really the only restriction that's in there.
I don't actually want to spend more than, 2 minutes on this. So
I'll start the timer.
I'm looking at the timer right now. Okay. And I'm already in 7 seconds into it. You almost went to jail.
Yes, I did almost go to jail.
So what happened?
The really short version of that is I had spent 5 years. Yeah, the really short version is I had spent 5 years working for Intel Corporation as a contractor. And one of the things you do as a contractor is you always want to be extremely useful. So you end up doing more than what the contract says in hopes that they will then pat you on the back for that. And one of these actions that I took was that I had noticed that the group I had formerly been working for had been a little lax in their security. I ran a standard security probe against that called Crack to see if they had been keeping up with what I had set as a standard when I'd worked in that group. And as it turns out, they hadn't. And as I was preparing a report to turn in to my bosses to say, look at this group that I used to work for within Intel. I'm still at Intel, but let's look at this group over here. They're not doing their job. As I was preparing this report, my coworker noticed that I was running Crack, not knowing why I was doing that. He went to Intel Security. Intel Security went to the cops. And 48 hours later, I had cops at my door arresting me essentially on charges that I was committing computer crime.
And then how long did it take before you got out from under this?
Well, I'm not out from under it yet, so let's see. That's now 12 years. The big problem is actually 14 years now. Oh, my God. It's just racking there. This was in 93 that I was arrested. I went to trial in 95. I got convicted of 3 felonies. I spent 5 years on probation. I had 480 community service hours. I had to do $67,000 in restitution.
Jeez, just for that?
That's a long story. If you want to get the full story, it's lightlink.com/FORS. Yeah, so just Google for my name. Yeah, I can say that. My name, right?
Yeah, so let's wrap it up, so that part anyway. We have so many more things to cover.
Yes.
But it's worth knowing, at the time, this was quite the cause among open source people. We were all shocked. We were just simply shocked.
I'm sure you weren't shocked as much as I was.
I can assure you that is true.
Yeah, okay,
you
know? Right, yes.
But yeah, it was really something, and it was desperately unfair. But anyway, yes.
By the way, he's still doing that kind of stuff. I just want you to know that when we go on these geek cruises, the first thing Randall does...
sets up a sniffer.
He does, because he wants the geek cruisers to know that they're sending their email password in the clear, so he'll come up to them with a little piece of paper and say, is this your email password?
I'm just saying, because I'm seeing it,
and I just want you to know.
Well, there was even I won't mention the name because I don't want to embarrass him too heavily, but there was a guy on one of our cruises who, in fact, was teaching a network security course, and during the middle of that, I walked up and said, here's your password.
He loved that, I bet.
Oh, he still talks to me occasionally, but not with the same sort of freedom that he had before, yes.
So I'm going to ask you about some of the things you have in here.
Okay.
You say, my experiences of RMS versus Linus versus ESR.
Oh, now we.
What would you like to say about that?
I have to define this. We cannot just go like that. Linus, of course, Linus Torvalds. RMS, Richard M. Stallman, and ESR is Eric Raymond. These are the three towering giants of the free software movement. Okay, yes. Now go ahead.
Okay, so now that you're informed, everyone calls them by their initials, and Linus is just Linus.
It's actually good to know. It's ESR, RMS, and why isn't it LTV or whatever his middle name is?
Because it's Linux.
I think LTV is a kind of plane.
Okay.
So
and it's Linux, so you don't want it. You have to like correspond to that. So
yeah, all right.
Yeah. I really enjoy the time I get to spend with Linus. He is a very, very, very cool guy. We've had numbers of beers together, and I've gotten to meet his family and his kids. And
well, he's local to you now, right?
In fact, I have had lunch with him by just emailing him and saying, let's have lunch. And so we had lunch. He picked it up, so I owe him lunch. So, Linus, if you're listening, please hurry up, call back, and we'll get the next one set up.
And don't call Intel Security about
No, please don't. Exactly. But yeah, Linus is a really cool guy, very laid back, and just as a matter of contrast, I've also been on one geek cruise and a number of appearances at conferences with Richard Stallman, and of course Richard pounds the table saying it's GNU Linux, it's not just Linux. If you walk up to Linus and you say the words GNU Linux, he will take you in a head hold and say, don't ever say that in my presence again.
Really?
He won't say that publicly.
Interesting.
He won't put that on any kind of public net, and here I am now, sorry Linus, I had to let him know that that's how you feel about it. And I agree with him, and the reason I agree with him is, Linux is whatever Linus wanted to call it. You know, he said this, if it uses GNU utilities all over the place to make things work, this whole system is called Linux. He has the right to say that. There's nothing in the GPL that says, you know, anything that uses GNU tools has to have GNU slash in front of it. If there was, then RMS would have
people
a right to
it,
complain.
Yeah.
Would have a right to complain. But I think it's just that Richard feels left behind, that here Linux is getting all this promotion and Richard's getting left out of the picture. Now, admittedly, absolutely. What Richard did to create the Software Foundation, exactly what we needed when we needed it. But he is a general without a battle now. And I'll say that flat out. Yes, he's fighting little things here and there, but I think he's fighting things that no longer need his attention.
Well, and he doesn't do himself any favors by being so prickly about the whole GNU Linux thing.
Right,
frankly.
Right, yeah.
Whether he feels that way or not. I mean, I think if Linus feels that way, you know, at least he doesn't say anything about it. He's smart enough just to, you know, keep it
chill
to himself.
Out.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm surprised to hear him say that, frankly. It seems to me somewhat, I can understand Richard's point of view. Linux is Linux, but a Linux distribution that you buy is just as much Free Software Foundation stuff as it is Linux. More so, really.
But I can call it Fred, right? I can say that this combination of things is Fred.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing that needs to say GNU Fred. It's just right. Fred. It's just what I call it, and that's my argument there. This is what Linus wants to call the whole thing, and
anybody can call it anything they want. If you don't have to call it Linux either, if you don't want to. I mean, you can call it whatever you want, but it's nobody can really insist that it be called Linux anymore.
Right.
Yeah, either. Right.
So my bottom line is, I've partied with Richard. I've partied with Linus, and Linus is the better partier, so if we're going to respect one of the two, we're going to respect Linus
now,
on this
about
issue,
Eric?
And I appreciate
now, don't leave
can
Mr.
understand
Raymond
my reference.
Out here. What kind of partier is he?
Eric is an interesting character. My most memorable moment of him is that 4 years ago, I threw this huge party. It was the first of, actually the second of many parties.
You got to stop right there.
What?
People have to realize that when Randall says he throws a party, it's like we dropped a bomb. And it was atomic. And it sort of went off.
So you're saying he's got megaton parties.
Well, he's got these parties that he's been doing at the open source convention every year for the last, since before it was called that, right?
Yeah.
And well, it's a remarkable party. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. So basically, if you could think of having, you know, it's 800 of your closest friends over for 4 hours, buying them, you know, whatever.
With an open bar.
With an open bar. And on this particular party, this was in San Diego, I had a DJ at one end of the building and a live band at the other end. And Eric showed up and he said, "Can I play with
play my flute?"
And he brought his flute. He said, "Can I play with the band?" And I said, "It's up to them. If you want, you may." And so here was Eric Raymond jamming out with the band. And I've got pictures of that up on my website. Luckily, Derek Story from O'Reilly was there documenting the whole thing, shooting pictures.
Derek's quite the photographer.
And even Tim O'Reilly stopped by for a few minutes at that party. So I've got pictures of him at the party with me and him. And it was just an incredible event. And everybody had a great time. And that was the point. I mean, I really wanted to have people. I want to give back to the community a little bit. And although, you know, to tell the truth, tipping my hand a little bit, it looks like I spend $20,000, $30,000 on these parties. And I'll tell you, I do it for far cheaper than that. But I have some very special ways to get things bought for me. So, I mean, I'm trying to give back. I'm trying to make it so that people can recognize and have a good time. And luckily now, yes, I've built up this incredible reputation as being the party to go to. I have people calling me saying, "When is your party? We don't want to go up against it." And I say, "It's the same every year. It's always Wednesday night. Just deal with Wednesday night on this." So it really works out really well. And I really
enjoy
what
we do is we have a dinner, sort of a recruiting dinner, and we try to end it early enough so that people can go to the party.
You
know? Yeah. Even Google gets out of the way of Randall Schwartz's
parties.
Get
out of the way.
Absolutely.
So what you're saying is that Eric Raymond can party with the best of them.
Eric Raymond is a good guy.
Richard Stallman sing when Eric Raymond was playing the flute?
Richard wasn't something at that party. Okay. Richard and Eric.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
Richard and Eric tend not to be in the same room for any length of time.
It's ironic because they were friends before they ever knew each other.
Were they really?
Software. Yeah, they knew each other from the science fiction conventions.
The
big problem is that Richard is hardline, everything wants to be free. And everything wants to be anthropomorphized, too. But everything wants to be free. and Eric is a practical guy. He sort of saw the compromise necessary between open source, from closed source and open source. He saw that there was actually a place and a very appropriate place for businesses to slowly adopt free software under the radar. If we call it open source, if we call it, some parts locked up but some parts still open. And that compromise irritates Richard. So they are at loggerheads about that, and that's sort of interesting to watch the dialogue. We had them both on the first Linux cruise, and it was almost to fisticuffs before Mad Dog got in there and said, "Hey, look, guys, we need both of you, so just, chill." It was actually pretty fun. You haven't brought up Geek Cruises at all.
I've mentioned Geek Cruises three times.
Well, how about cruises then?
Wait, how many Geek Cruises have you been on now, Randall?
Oh, what about Geek Cruises? It just came to my mind. Yeah.
There we go. Well, I've been on 32 cruises so far.
Oh, my God.
No, it's wonderful.
But I love that.
And there's a Pearl Whirl with Larry Wall and Randall. And there's a, I'm going on a chess cruise in August with a bunch of grandmasters and Randall.
That's why I'd actually want to go on.
Yeah, you like chess?
You should go. Go, go, go.
Chess moves too.
Oh, man.
Hey, Polgar, Chris, I still got another berth. You can share my room.
No.
We might get him.
Now, you know who works here at Google is Tal. He's a grandmaster.
Mikhail Tal is. It's a different Tal.
No, it's a different.
Yeah. We had this. I had this conversation with you once before, I think.
Yeah, he did a simul here, man, where he kicked all our butts.
They're
it was
good.
Awesome.
They're good.
I was like solidly in the middle of the pack. Too.
There's a reason they're called grand.
Yeah. On one of the last cruises, we had Larry Christensen who did a four-way or five-way simul blindfolded. And he played white, black, white. So he actually had alternate turns to make.
Absurd.
In terms of, each player was like playing the other side
it's
of it.
Amazing.
So yeah, it was pretty amazing.
It's Tal Shaked.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he was playing against like Peter Norvig and people like that. And of course, he crushed
I bet there are quite a few good
chess players at?
There actually are. Yeah. Yeah.
In the geek community,
we have
for sure.
Only one grandmaster though. So
hey, that's all you need.
Yeah.
There's going to be Mac Mania 5 is coming up in November. I'm going on that one. October, November, I'm going on that one as well with Steve Wozniak and Randall Schwartz.
Why are you on all these?
He's on every one of them.
Well, I started out being the first speaker that was asked to the first cruise, and I liked it so much that I was also asked to be on the second one. And then for the third one, I couldn't figure out what to speak about because it was about something I wasn't smart about. And I just told Neil Bowen, I said, can I just carry your clipboard or something? And that just kept growing, and I kept going, well, why not keep going? I mean, it's my 6 weeks a year away from cell phones and pagers, and have a great time.
Right. It really is fun. I've come to become an addict to myself. It's really fun.
And yep. I even started my own podcast based on that, too, so people can listen to podcast.geekcruises.com and hear me talk to all these wonderful people we get to speak to.
The Cruises Newses.
Absolutely.
And we'll get you on one of these, Chris, and your wife.
Well, is it?
It's a family thing.
Have to pay for it, though?
Well,
if you're not a featured speaker,
you have
yes.
to speak if you don't want to.
No, right, I'm so if you... You spend the entire week like a monk. No, you can't go.
In your cabin.
Damn.
Yes.
Silent and celibate. So okay, I'm excited about Pearl 6. When are we going to see Pearl 6?
I saw a lot of work being made in Pearl 6, a lot of presentations. In fact, at this last conference, and last week at YAPSE, the yet another Pearl conference, was in Chicago this year, and my company Stonehenge sponsored it in a big way. And I also did both Brian Foy and I did trainings on Thursday and Friday to actually bring people up to speed on the existing Pearl literature. But on Tuesday, Brian and I delivered the very first Learning Pearl for Pearl 6 using the Pearl 6 syntax.
How
and everything.
Exciting!
So we are that close. We ran all of the things that we showed up on the screen. We actually ran them using the current Pearl 6 as it exists today.
So and I'm going to have to relearn everything.
No. Everything you know will still work. The syntax may be a little different for some of the common things, but the rest is it's whatever you know, whatever you like about Pearl, it's still going to work. It's still going to be in there, but we're opening up a lot more standardized ways to create classes and objects and better things about exception handling and control, better things about threading, basically solving a lot of the issues that people sort of looked at Pearl 5 and went, well, it's kind of nice, but it sure does this in a really weird way. And so we're simplifying all that. We're making it a much straightforward language, much more modern language, really coming up with the times. And it's about time. Pearl 5's been around for 10 years now, and that's a long time any language to have done. Now, it's gone through a number of minor revisions. But Pearl 6, I'm guessing, and every time I'm going to guess, it's going to be perhaps a wrong thing. I mean, their official answer is going to come by Christmas, but they never say what year. I'm guessing at this point, based on the progress that I'm seeing, based on the independent implementations, actually, the Pearl 6 and Pearl 5, various ways to pipe the two things together, I'm guessing you're going to see an alpha by the end of this year, a usable beta by summer of next year, maybe at the OSCON 07, or YAPSE 07, depending on where they get first. I don't think it's going to be adopted by industry until at least 6 months or years after that, because the industry is not. You wouldn't put a critical website on Pearl 6 probably for another year after summer of 07.
But as a Pearl programmer, I'll start using it probably in the next year.
Yeah, I think you'll be able to pull down the beta in summer of 07, and you'll be seeing most of the language. Maybe a few of your favorite things don't work yet, or maybe some of the more complex things, or some of the stuff of the to map legacy code into it. That may not fully be there quite yet, but I think you'll have the basics completely usable. It'll be faster. Everything right now that we're seeing on Parrot benchmarking shows that when we finally get everything compiled down to that, it's going to be a faster language, which is really exciting
to
us.
Yeah, that's really great. Yeah.
Yep. Not to mention that everything can be compiled down to bytecodes, and you save the bytecodes around just like the way Python and Java's been doing it for years.
Not to mention there'll be an entirely new Learning Pearl and Intermediate Pearl book necessary.
Absolutely. New training
and
courses from Stonehenge.
Pearl with objects and libraries.
Have you started working on those, Randall?
I am. I'm actually starting on those. That's actually what this class was that we were just teaching,
So that's that's going to be the core for the new book.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So the last thing is Git.
Git. One of the things when I had lunch with Linus earlier, actually late middle of last year, I said, what are you actually working on these days? And he goes, well, you know, that whole BitKeeper thing was really kind of a mess. And I'm working right now on this thing that's basically going to be the distributed version control system for the Linux kernel. And I went, yay, that's kind of cool. And so he encouraged me to check it out, and I did. And I've actually been an active contributor now on the Git mailing list, making sure that it runs on something other than Linux, because I'm running it on my my OS X laptop, and I'm also running an OpenBSD on my server. And I have to make sure it works there. And so I'm actually one of the people making sure that it's still portable, which is really nice, and I'm contributing back. A lot of components are in Perl, so I'm making contributions about how the parts are written in Perl. Nothing Linus does is written in Perl, but they have a lot of other people contributing to that that are doing Perl stuff, so I'm trying to provide advice when I can about the things they're doing that are right and wrong.
Great. That's it. Cool. That's all I got.
We did the whole list.
All right.
Wow. It's been great talking to you, Randall. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's been really good.
So appreciate you guys taking the time to interview me and hang out with me.
A lot of fun.
I love open source. I love what you guys have done with the show, and I'm really honored to have been one of your participants. I'm looking forward to hearing how it sounds on the podcast when I download it.
Definitely our pleasure. And that's it for another edition of Floss Weekly. Chris DeBona, it's a pleasure having you and your wacky cohorts. Grace.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, you don't need me, because they a lot of them know you, and they worship the ground you work on.
But that's not true. But I think that your Rolodex is second to none in the open source community. And
it's kind of good to say.
It's fun to get to talk to some of these people. And yeah, I happen to have known Randall, but you know, that's.
I was actually surprised at how many cruises that you guys have done together. I mean, 30 plus.
No, I haven't been on 32. He's been on 32. I've been on, I think, 4 or 5.
That's a lot of drama. I mean, that's all I'm going
to. Oh no, they're fun. We really are. And if people want to know more, geekcruises.com. It really is.
Yeah, for
sure. The thing is to get to hang out with people like Randall. I mean, I have yet to ask him a Perl question because I'm so intimidated by him. But I know a lot more about Brazilian alcohol than I ever thought I would. Let's put it that way. All right. We'll see you next week for another episode of Floss Weekly. Take care.
Goodbye, everybody.
I get the Kermit thing going. Hold on a second.
Yeah, let's hear it. Here we go.
Okay, this is without warming up, so it's going to be a little rough, but... Hi-ho, Kermit the Frog here. Today on Sesame Street, we're going to look at the number 3. Whee! Someday we'll find it, the Rainbow Connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
That is superlative.
Wow.
I felt Jim Henson in the room there.
And I just scared everybody that's in the office next to me.